Broadcasting from Youngstown, Ohio, this is the MV Red Podcast, the show where we talk about news and politics impacting the Mahoning Valley, the state of Ohio, and the USA. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, find us on your favorite podcast streaming app or visit our website, www.mvred.com. If you want to share your opinion with us, please email info@mvred.com, as we would love to hear from you. Now, let's get things started. Here are your hosts, Michael Metzinger and Dane Davis.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of the MV Red Podcast. There we go. Sorry about that, everybody. Just wanted to make sure everything got set up properly. Welcome to episode 12 of the MV Red Podcast. I'm Michael Metzinger, and let's see here if I can do this right. There's Dane Davis. And on today's episode, we got a lot to talk about, a lot of random things, lots going on in the world of politics and in our lives right now, especially with the coronavirus, as a lot of states are beginning to open up, and it seems as though we're starting to get our lives back slowly but surely. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk about some masks, you know, the whole thing with wearing masks as states open up. We're going to talk a little bit about Joe Biden. I know, you know, another interesting gaffe here in the last week that I wanted to share, and I know Dane wanted to chit-chat a little bit about Uncle Joe Biden. And we could also talk about the Ohio primary election results. Christina Hagan had a big win in, I think, a 7 or 8 person field. She got something like 62% of the vote. So we'll talk a little bit about this and that throughout the hour. And we also have a special guest lined up for you who will be joining us momentarily. But if you guys have any questions throughout the evening, by all means, chime in the chat, send us questions, and let us know what you guys want us to talk about. So first off, I got my nice USA shirt here on. I'm sure the USA shirt was probably made in like Bangladesh or something like that, but it is what it is. So Dane, what's going on with you?
Hey, Michael. It's been a long week of investment banking. We got to keep deals alive. We got to keep the economy going. It's in here. I'm having a nice glass of Malbec. Normally, I boycott Argentinian wines because of their unjustified actions in the Falkland Islands War, where they invaded the Falkland Islands from the UK. I don't know if I bought this or somebody else bought it for me, because I boycott any wines from Argentina, but I have it, so I'm drinking it. It's pretty good, I have to say. I have to give them some credit. But it's beautiful Geauga County, God's own county here in Ohio, and the reddest county in the state of Ohio, fun fact.
And I'm just relaxing. Flooding out there today?
We did. There was a lot of rain, but I think it's past us, and we'll survive. We've got good infrastructure. We're a well-governed county. And now I'm just sitting back, relaxing, and seeing what Michael Metzinger is about to ask me. I'm really excited for our special guest tonight, Tommy Metzinger. He's Michael's big brother, the oldest of the Metzinger clan. There's like 80 of you, right? And he's the oldest. That's cool.
There's quite a few of us.
And we're gonna have a great show. I think it's gonna be great. I think it's just, you know, the theme of this episode is good vibing, right? Sit back, relax. Just chill out and good vibing, as the Zoomers would say. Are you a Zoomer, Michael? What year were you born?
Were we born like around the same year, 89?
Oh, wow. 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 They grow up so fast. So we're both millennials. So you're not a Zoomer. But still, we can still good vibe, right? Even though you're a Zoomer, we can still enjoy good vibes.
Yeah. So I guess, what do you want to start off with first? And, I'll have my brother Tom join momentarily. I have one more thing my brother Tom needs to do before he could join us, so I'll be touching base with him momentarily.
Well, what do you want to talk about? I mean, there's a lot going on, but there's really not a lot going on at the same time. You know, I feel like the issue set is kind of similar since the last episode. you know, it's coronavirus all the time. The country's become more polarized. It's the gradual reopening. I mean, we're clearly in the reopening phase of the epidemic, whatever you want to call it. And now we've got the presidential election that's going on. Yeah, it's a presidential election year. I bet you forgot, because I forgot. So you pick the topic, Michael. You pick. I also want to talk about the care emoji, but we can save that for the end. I think that's a really crucial topic.
I've been using it quite a bit, and I like to use it in very random situations on Facebook. I've been using the care emoji just for the hell of it, because why not?
Right.
So you brought up a good point, though, and we'll start with this, about polarization.
Yeah.
And I think you nailed this probably our 9th or 10th episode. We started talking about the shutdown or lockdown, whatever, what you would want to call it. And you said, if this goes on longer than people maybe were initially told or the initial expectation, what we're seeing happening now is starting to take place, where there's a lot of pushback to, especially at the end of April, when Dr. Amy Acton had the Stay Safe Ohio Order. I know it's called the Stay Safe Ohio Order, but I believe it reads stay home. It's like another stay home order through the end of May. And again, social media, don't read too much into it, but it's a polarizing environment. But a lot of pushback was taking place to DeWine and Acton, because this, you know, they gave this maybe initial idea, you know, we flattened the curve. Ohio did a great job with flattening the curve. Our hospital capacity it was there, and we were able to meet the demands of COVID patients. So we did that. So when Acton introduced an order that lasts until the end of May, and we're only midway through this now, there seemed to be a lot of pushback. And I think you kind of saw this coming.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about the coronavirus, right? There's a couple things going on, right? First of all, there's the virus itself. It's a novel virus. And I'm not a doctor. I'm into finance. You're an accountant, right? So this is in our field. We're not experts in it, right? So I don't want to get over my skis too much, as they say, to use that tired cliche. But it's a new virus. And, you know, when it was first released, it was released in China. And that's a crucial point, right? And the point is not, you know, some tired xenophobia or nationalism, but it's really crucial because the Chinese covered it up initially, right? When Trump says the China virus, or when Cuomo, he says this new thing, it's the European virus, which isn't really true. It started in China. It's really important to emphasize the fact that it started in China, because the Chinese totalitarian regime covered it up, and they prevented, you know, other organizations from getting to the truth about what was going on or for finding out. And they lied. And the end result of these lies, right, through their mouthpiece, the World Health Organization, which is a total puppet of the Chinese state. The end result was the United States and the entire globe was kind of caught off guard. And we can talk about Trump's response and all that, and you can go into that along. But the world was not ready, because China lied. They covered it up, and they were fabricating data, results, et cetera. So, you know, as I've said time and time again, I think Governor DeWine and many of the governors throughout America made the right decision. This was a new virus. It seemed very severe from the limited data that we were getting. And the idea was, we've got to protect lives, right? Well, that was in February, early March. We'll call it mid-March, actually. Since then, we've had around 6 to 8 weeks of new data. Not theories, not models, but actual hard data. And the data shows something very clear. This is a real virus. It affects people worse than the flu, but it affects certain groups worse than the flu, primarily the elderly and people aged 75 and older. Not even, if you were to break it down by age, not even really the 50 to 60 cohort or the 60 to 70 cohort, but really once you get over 70, 75, does it really start to affect you? So the elderly population is particularly vulnerable. Children, young adults like you and me, we seem to be fine, right, in terms of fatalities. So we have new information, and there's good news. This is really good news. It's not as bad as we thought. It is bad for particular groups. And, you know, I think as new data comes in, the strategy has to change. And the strategy should now be open up the economy, get people back to work, right? Not because of a 401k or anything like that. and start to protect the vulnerable populations. We now know who's vulnerable, and the vulnerable populations are the elderly. And it allows us to adjust, right? And if you were just to kind of strip away all the rhetoric from both the left and the right, I think that's the new strategy. If you're in a nursing home, we're going to have really stringent standards, right? If you're Dane Davis or Michael Metzinger, the chance that you're going to get really severely infected from this, even like feel it, most cases are asymptomatic, right? Most people get it and don't even know it. You could have had it. I could have had it. We don't know, right? So it's not as bad as we thought. But that said, there are certain vulnerable groups, and we now need to shift our resources, which are always limited, to protect these vulnerable groups. So that's my take on the whole thing. I know that's very controversial, but that's how I view it.
No, I agree with most of those points. In our, I don't know if it's the last episode before, we talked about the lack of transparency coming out of the World Health Organization in China, and how that really prevented, I think, the country as a whole to really prepare for the severity of this crisis. The Chinese numbers, I think we could all agree, regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, are laughable. I mean, we see it now with these tests where maybe in some parts of the country, 15 or 20% of people ended up having it or tested positive for the antibody test. And for that country of, what, 1 billion people to only have 80,000
1.6. That's a lot.
To only have 80,000 cases is laughable. So we started off in a tough situation. And fortunately, in our country, we're much more, I guess, transparent with information and data. And the more information that comes out, I think it's becoming abundantly clear that a one-size-fits-all strategy that was what was initially introduced to flatten the curve and whatever these other catchy hashtag slogans are, they did their job. But with the more information we're getting now, you can't continue to force people not to go back to work and to live their lives when certain segments of our population, certain demographics, are clearly not really impacted in any way, shape, or form. I'm going to pull it up right now, but WKBN here locally, here in Youngstown, had some interesting stats on COVID-19 in Mahoning County, which is one of the harder hit counties in the state. Death rate, I still think it might be the highest in the state.
It's also one of the oldest counties in the state.
Exactly.
Right?
Correct. And here are some of the numbers here. 59% of those testing positive in Mahoning County were age 60 and over. Only 9% of the cases have been for people under the age of 30. So it kind of in our realm, our age range, although I just did eclipse the age of 30. Eight months ago, whatever it was. Of those hospitalized, 74% were 60 and over, and only 2% were under the age of 30. But here is the stat that needs to be emphasized. 69% came from long-term care facilities, and 99% of cases in this county, or those that have test positive, according to these stats from WKBN, had underlying health conditions. So based on all of that, clearly those who have underlying health conditions, this is a very dangerous virus that could impact you and it could possibly be lethal. But if you're especially, let's say, under the age of 50 and you're healthy and you have no real known underlying health conditions of any sort, the odds of it impacting you, especially in a critical fashion, just clearly, the more information we're seeing now, clearly shows it just does not appear to be the case. So that's why I think you're seeing a lot of these states start to open up with the emphasis on those maybe age 60 plus and those with underlying conditions to stay home. Because clearly, you can't continue to say everybody stay home when really it's a small – not a small. I mean, it could be 25, 30% of the population. You stay home. The rest of you – take precautions, go back to work, live your lives, but just be mindful of the fact there are other people out there who are vulnerable.
So let's start dropping some, as they say on the internet, some red pills, right? Let's get a little spicy. I'm on my second glass of wine, right? Everything you just said is reasonable. We're trying not to throw partisan lines about it, but let's actually – the red states, there has been a – we have had a biased media in this – we have a biased media. We haven't have had. We have a biased media in this country. And the media has spread two memes, right? The first meme, Governor Andrew Cuomo is a great governor. He's such a good leader. He's a really strong leader, right? He's so smart. He really has it together. That crazy Donald Trump, he's completely off the wall. That's the first meme, that Andrew Cuomo has done a great job throughout this crisis. The second meme, Governors Kemp of Georgia, Governors DeSantis of Florida, Governor Abbott of Texas. These are cruel, heartless Republicans. They're opening up because they want to make money and they want to keep the economy going and they want to kill old people. And gosh, aren't they just so hypocritical? These are the same pro-life governors, and yet they're willing to sacrifice grandma to the, you know, the ash heap of history in exchange for opening up so they can make a few more dollars, right? Those are the two memes that have been going out. And both of those are objectively wrong. And they're objectively wrong, and the media has not been called out on these things. Okay. This is verifiable. We have a it's empirical, right? This isn't like, you know, is the death penalty right or wrong, where it becomes a value judgment. The media freaked out 3 or 4 weeks ago, actually even before that, in the middle of April, so 1 month ago, when they said Ron DeSantis was opening up the beaches. How dare he open up the beaches? People in Florida are going to die. Aren't they so stupid? You know, people are going to die by the dozens in Florida because they're opening up the beaches. And guess what? Guess what? There was no surge of mass deaths. There was no surge of hospitalizations. Governor Kemp, Trump called him out wrongly and said, oh, you're opening up too early. This is a bad idea, right? Governor Kemp opened up the state of Georgia. Guess what? Georgia, as of I think yesterday, hit the lowest level of new cases of COVID-19. They have seen no surge in hospitalization, no surge in deaths, right? And, you know, they might see like a rise in like 50 cases or 50 deaths or 100 deaths, right? But it's important to keep in mind perspective. These are states of Florida, I think, has 20 million people. Georgia, I imagine, is around.
It's a larger state than Florida or than New York now.
Yeah, it's a larger state, right? And there's been no mass chaos, mass anarchy, right? So what really angers me is we have spread these memes out, and they've done through a partisan lens, and one side has been consistently wrong. And instead of saying, you know what, we're wrong, let's have some more humility when we approach this issue, they double down. And what I really don't appreciate is the attempts to equate people that question the policy response, not the virus itself, but the policy response to the virus, which should be up for debate. These people are described as like hillbillies, as rednecks, as ignorant, as stupid, as malicious. They want people to die, et cetera, et cetera. And it's totally unjustifiable. I think you got a little feedback, Michael. I'm hearing a little feedback on your mic.
Tommy Matthews has joined the podcast. Audio wise, I'm working to get him on actually on the video right now.
Cool.
Yeah.
Mike, Tommy, can you mute your speakers, please, or put on headphones?
Yeah, my bad.
Oh, hey, Tommy. We got right, Tommy Metzinger, the oldest Metzinger brother. Too, how's good. It going?
Oh, I know. Wow. I'm working on getting you on the camera too. I apologize.
What do you mean by calling me a big guest in all caps?
You're the biggest brother. Yeah. You're the oldest brother. It's a big surprise.
Putting on the quarantine 15.
No, I would never do that. I would never make fun of a Metzinger. I don't make fun of Michael. I don't make fun of his degenerate brother. I don't make fun of the smart one, and I don't make fun of you, Tommy. You guys are all great kids.
You're all right yourself, buddy.
So, while I work on this, Dane, you did mention something about the different states, and I think much needs to be – we need to touch on the – if I can get this to work, and give me one moment here, folks. Well, apparently it's not going to work, of course. We're just having lots of technical difficulties tonight. Nonetheless, it was the order from Governor Cuomo, and let me see if I get the date on this. Just that kind of put it in perspective as we were talking about. So this was on March 25th, New York Department of Health. It was an advisory for hospital discharges and admissions to nursing homes. And it, it says, and it's underlined, and I would show it on the screen if I could get it to work, but it says, no resident shall be denied readmission or admission to the I'm trying to see what they're calling this, nursing home, solely based on a confirmed or suspected diagnosis of COVID-19. I looked at the numbers, and there's an AP count. Associated Press did a look into this, and of the total number of deaths right now, and this may have been as of a couple of days ago, there are 5,300 deaths in New York State in long-term care facilities, which if wow. you look at that, those numbers across the entire country, that would be if that was – just a state alone, it would be good for third most in the entire country. But it's to me fascinating how it's just not being talked about nearly as much as one would think. They're kind of just casually ignoring it, and unfortunately, it's one could argue it's cost thousands of lives. And but
people, you know, Cuomo mugged on CNN where he got interviewed by his less intelligent younger brother, and you know, oh Cuomo, you're such a good leader. Oh Cuomo, wow, I wish you were president. Hint, hint, wink, wink. Oh Cuomo, you know, you're really doing well, right? He has these little press conferences where he talks about his grandma's meatballs, right? And every middle-aged woman in America swoons for him. Well, I shouldn't say that. That's actually insulting to women. I think some middle-aged women in America swoon for him. And they're like, oh, he's such a good leader. He had a really good press conference where he talked about spaghetti for 4 hours. And he had really nice PowerPoints made by McKinsey consultants, right? And the reality of the situation is the spread of the virus has come from New York State, specifically New York City, right? The deaths are because of Cuomo's order to send infected patients to the nursing homes where it spread like Kindle. By the way, it's not just Andrew Cuomo. Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania implemented a similar order. And this is what's really disturbing about Pennsylvania. The head of the Department of Health for Pennsylvania, or the equivalent position to Dr. Amy Acton in Ohio, is led by someone named Rachel Levine or Rachel Levine. That person took her own mother out of the nursing homes, right, when this was breaking, but meanwhile sent everybody else's infected mom or dad to the nursing homes, right? And it spread throughout, and it's killed, unfortunately, a lot of people. I think something like north of I want to say around 50%, but don't quote me, but a significant percentage of Pennsylvania's coronavirus deaths have become in the nursing homes. So meanwhile, so here's what really makes me mad. DeSantis is an idiot. He's greedy. Kemp is an idiot. He's greedy. Abbott is an idiot. He's greedy. Whitmer is such a leader. Cuomo is such a leader. Wolf is such a leader. Newsom's such a leader. Yet those are the blue state governors, the ones that have screwed this up, right? It's just the numbers. They've done a poor job of managing it. They've made some bad decisions. And look, you know, in the early part of the virus, I get it, right? Because there was a lack of full information. But it shows you that we don't have a fair media in the United States because they're constantly spinning for the blue team, right? Unfortunately, America is divided into red team and blue team. And, you know, the media mostly aligns with the blue team, and they will spin for the blue team nonstop. And even in a situation where they screwed up big time. So there you go. That's my take on it.
No, I'm glad. And I do want to add. So my brother Tom is definitely connected right now on our podcast side, where we're actually recording the podcast for publishing, I guess, after the show. But for some reason, it's not allowing me to show his webcam or add his audio, so I'm going to at least try to attempt a few other things here in the meantime. So I do apologize to Tom, and I do apologize to those listening, if especially those in the chat, because those are the ones who aren't going to be able to hear Tom. So I do apologize for that. But yeah, you mentioned the Pennsylvania Director of Health, I believe.
Yeah, let me get the official.
Levine or something like that. But yeah, with her, yeah. The order, and They had the order where they would go back to the nursing home. Yet she, like, I think, I don't know if you just mentioned this. I apologize if I didn't hear this, but how she took her mother or father.
Yeah.
Out of the nursing home, which is just ridiculous. So
look, here's my point, right? The point is not to cast blame. In disaster like situation, there are bad things happening. I get that. But my point is that the US media is actively spinning, right? And they're spinning for the blue team. And here's the other thing that really, really bugs me. And I think in actuality, there's a bit of classism here, is when people make fun of those protesters, okay? Look, there's an alliance between two socioeconomic groups, actually three. Retired people who get a paycheck from Social Security. They don't care whether the economy starts up or not, right? They get income. White-collar workers, like myself, and I think yourself, we're still getting paid from our companies. We're working remotely. We're just as productive, right? It's not so bad for the white-collar workers. And people that are on unemployment, which the benefits have been increased by $600 per week or per period – these three groups have made an alliance where they're incentivized to keep the economy shut down as long as possible. So these groups, right, are attacking the people. And I'm not going to say I agree with the way that this group present themselves, but these are people, the people that have been protesting. They've been like, reopen the economy, please, right? These are people that have lost their jobs. These are people that have lost their livelihoods, their businesses. These are not the wealthy. These are not like some rich plutocrat ordering their workers back into the factory. This is the petite bourgeois, right? The bourgeoisie. These are the heart and soul of this country, the small business owner. They've lost their entire livelihoods and they were willing to go along with it. And now they're saying, hey, open up, let us go back to work. We just want to work. That's not a horrible thing. And yeah, some of the protests, the costumes and that are stupid. Yeah, carrying guns around, probably not the best idea. I think it's a bad look visually, right? But these people are the salty earth types. And then there's this classist position which makes fun of them for people who haven't lost their job or who are getting the unemployment paycheck saying these guys are ignorant and they want to kill people. They don't want to kill people. Nobody. Let's just put this out there. Nobody on either side of the divide really wants to kill other people, right? But they're worried about their livelihoods. And you have the people on the left making fun of these people. And I think it's really, really interesting to me that the left claims to speak for the worker. The left claims to speak for the working class. But yet the actual working class, which is being demolished by this, the left smugly loves every opportunity to make fun of them and to put them down. And I'm just sick of it. I think it's gross. So, yeah, there you go. That's my other point.
Fired up tonight, Dane.
Yeah.
So
we got to get you fired up, Michael.
Yeah. I mean, there's different, I guess, things. I'm trying to, they get me fired up with, and I guess let's go to the state of Ohio. Let's talk DeWine.
Let's talk DeWine.
So DeWine's been a fascinating politician. We talked about him like one of our real early episodes, how he's not your typical Republican in any way, shape, or form.
No.
And what's fascinating to me in Columbus right now, Republicans have control of the state Senate, 23-9, something like that. They have control of the House, like 59 to whatever. I don't know. It's a pretty...
So they have big majorities in both.
Yeah, big majorities in both. The loudest critics right now of DeWine in Columbus aren't Democrats. They're his people from his own party, it seems as though. And I think what really set him off was that Dr. Acton stay safe at home order, and they're trying to put something in place where they kind of limit her authority or the executive authority to put something in place along those lines. But I just think it's been kind of fascinating to watch the dynamics of the state Republicans kind of duking it out with DeWine. This isn't the first time this has happened. I know there was issues with the budget. I believe it was last year. And then this year, the whole thing with Ed Choice, the school vouchers for private schools, that's still not solved. They just kind of kicked the can down for another year. But it's been really fascinating to me to watch the Republicans not unified whatsoever, it seems.
So DeWine, if he were any type of politician, he would be a Christian Democrat. So a Christian Democrat, there are parties in Europe, right? They're called, it's a movement called Christian Democracy, where it's they're on the right side of the spectrum, but they believe in a strong welfare state. They're capitalist. They're not socialist. They're conservative on morality. And it's kind of a European phenomenon. We don't really have it here in the United States. But if DeWine were anything, he would kind of fit into that category. And I say Christian Democrat, but in the European context, they don't mean Democratic Party, right? They just mean they believe in democracy, but with Christian overtones. Ohio is divided between two really powerful factions. Mike DeWine, who has a base of support, is kind of, I don't even say he's a moderate, right? He's kind of his own blend of politics. And then Speaker Larry Householder of the Ohio House of Representatives is a very, very powerful individual. And notably, he was elected with Democratic support. But he has been all in on the move to reopen the state of Ohio. And look, I think Amy Acton and Mike DeWine have done a good job. I'm not opposed to them. I get the phase reopening. I think that they're doing it in response to business pressures, right? Like, I get that, and I support DeWine. I get why he called the quarantine. I think he could have lifted it 2 or 3 weeks earlier, even 4 or 5 weeks earlier, and we probably wouldn't have seen much of a significant difference in cases. But I completely understand where he's coming from, and he's finally starting to open the state up. He's being overly cautious, in my opinion, but I get it, okay? I also get, though, the perspective of the House Republicans. Their constituents are losing their jobs, their businesses, their incomes, their way of life. 25% of all restaurants are expected to shut down permanently, right? This is devastating to people. So I get why they're speaking out. And I think that the bill that they propose is actually quite reasonable. If we were to take a step back, right, at any sort of crisis, the public health director and the governor have the right to act, and they have the right to act unilaterally, right? To quote the Federalist Papers, we want urgency and dispatch in our executive branch. But thereafter, when we have time to process the crisis, that immediate action must fall under the peer review, must be ratified by some form of popular body. So the bill that they proposed in the House of Representatives, where it said, you know, they have to ratify essentially Amy Acton's orders, I think it's a reasonable compromise, right? And I don't think people, you know, if the virus were killing 50,000 people per day in Ohio, they're not going to open up the state, right? Let's have a little bit of reasonableness. The fact that, you know, the death rates and the hospitalization rates haven't met the models, that's why there's this push to reopen. It's not just a let's open for the hell of it. So I think that's a really fair compromise. And I get it. I'm in favor of it.
Yeah. So I'll get the one credit. He is opening the state up, and I think he, and I'm adding you back to the stream right now, so I do apologize to those in the chat. Dane did disappear there. Let's see if we get him on here.
I think I'm back. I just refreshed it. You should see me.
Wait one moment.
3, 2.
Should we?
It's just not our night with the technology.
Sorry about that, folks.
It's fine. So while we work on that, though, I'll give him this. I haven't agreed with everything he's done, but I do give him credit. By the end of this month, it seems as though most of the state will open up. Were there times throughout the past 8 weeks where I had issues? I took issue with Governor DeWine and his positions and maybe allowing Dr. Acton to kind of run things maybe a little bit more than I would have hoped. Yes. But ultimately, I think he's really taking in all the information. I think he's taking in the information from Dr. Acton. I think he's taking in the data, the hard data, and I'll give him credit. I would have expected a lot more in terms of restrictions with restaurants opening up. I recall a couple articles a few weeks ago where a lot of restaurant owners thought they were going to be the last ones to open up. And not only they were able to open up today to outdoor seating, but they're going to be able to open up, I believe, maybe sometime next week to in-person seating inside the restaurants. And there's really not a ton of restrictions at all, which I kind of was surprised about. So I'll give him that. I think he's responsibly opening up Ohio. And if anything, you know, if we want to be a little bit nitpicky. Maybe 2-3 weeks earlier may have been better. One could argue, or maybe somebody like myself would argue. But nonetheless, he's opening up, whereas a state like California right now, God only knows what the heck they're doing over there.
Yeah, if you guys missed it out, apologies for the live stream. I think the podcast version will have this. But I basically said that I don't always agree with DeWine, but I think he's done the right thing by and large. And I get it, right? It's been tough. Yeah, I think he's done a decent job. Here, I'm just rejoining the stream. Sorry about that. We've had technical difficulties. It's a cursed episode.
I agree. And it's funny. We've gone through 11 other ones, and we really never had any issues whatsoever.
Do you think the government's trying to prevent us from getting the truth out there?
Maybe.
I'm back in. Okay. Can you bring me back in the stream? There we go. I'm live now. Okay. I'm here. Thanks. So why don't we spice it up? Why don't we move to Joe Biden? Do you want to talk Joe Biden? I love talking Joe Biden.
Let's talk Joe Biden here.
Michael, you know, you normally ask the question, but I'm going to switch roles here. What do you think about the Biden campaign so far? Like, what do you think about that? We could elect our first dementia American president as president with Joe Biden. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's becoming more abundantly clear that there's certainly a cognitive decline. And yes, I am not a doctor. But again, we've been saying this from our first episode. Go watch Joe Biden when he was vice president. Go watch the debate with Joe Biden against Sarah Palin. He did not have – did he have the occasional gaffe where he would say something questionable? Yeah. You could call these things gaffes now. But it's – to me, it's clear that his – the mental decline is intensifying, and I'm just kind of shocked, to be honest with you, that it hasn't become a greater issue. I honestly believe there are many Democrats that acknowledge that he has memory issues that we're starting to see it come to light. But I think they're willing to still vote for him with the hope that whoever the vice presidential candidate is, they may end up taking him. I know that might sound bizarre. I know it might sound a bit out there to say something like that. But it's almost every week now. And these aren't – the one this week occurred where he was in his basement doing this digital – interview with Governor Whitmer from Michigan and a few other people, and he's talking about coronavirus response and how he's getting and he's having a meeting every single day with some doctor or another, and it's about a 25 or 30 second clip where he's just stumbling through it and it's like and trying to figure out what the doctor's name is and this and that. And listen, we're I wish this was an election about issues, but we have to talk.
No, but it is.
I know, but I'm saying we have to talk about this because.
Yeah.
Do you really think, in my eyes, do you really think he'd be fit right now to be leading this country during this crisis? When he's stumbling in interviews where it's just him in his basement with like a camera just set up against the wall, I mean, please, people, I mean. Keep that in mind. I'm not Trump's biggest fan, and we've aired our grievances about Donald Trump and especially his personality on this episode frequently. But get real, people. I mean, are you going to really vote for a man who clearly has memory issues? I mean, this is the most important job, obviously, in our country, and one of the most important jobs in the entire world.
You know, I was kind of facetious earlier when I described him as a dementia American. I just want to say, like, look, dementia is a horrible illness, and I don't wish it upon anybody, right? And I really feel bad for the man. I feel pity. But let's be real with ourselves. There's something seriously happening to Joe Biden. He's not all there. And it's really unfortunate, but like there were videos out today where he was like talking to a pre-recording and didn't realize it was a pre-recording. I mean, like every day he's in front of the camera. These aren't gaffes, right? Gaffes are like you say something silly like, hey, I'm glad to be here in Indianapolis and you're in Des Moines, Iowa, right? A gaffe is something, you know, you accidentally let out. Joe Biden has serious mental cognitive declines, right? And it's such an awkward topic because nobody's happy that this is happening. I'm not trying to gloat. Right? If that's the impression I'm giving off, I apologize. But there's something seriously wrong with him. And, you know, shame on his family for letting him run, number one. And shame on the Democratic Party for nominating him and putting him forward. As their candidate for president. I think it increasingly comes down to one is they might replace him on the ticket with Andrew Cuomo. Maybe. We'll see. I think Cuomo probably has a lot of skeletons in his closets that's going to prevent that. Two, it depends on who they pick as the VP. You know, I've heard Stacey Abrams, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, all these various candidates. And I'd actually be interested to get your insights. Who do you think would be the strongest? Who do you think would be the weakest? Biden's already said it has to be a woman. So it's probably going to be a woman candidate. But I think it's really, really unfortunate. Look, Trump is a kind of a weird dude. He speaks in convoluted sentences. He kind of meanders sometimes. But I'd say overall, he's relatively sharp. Like if you look at the vast bulk of press conferences he's done, he's on top. Like he knows where he is, he knows who people are, etc. I know it's a low standard, but like I don't think he is losing it, right? But Biden, I don't think so. Like here's a trick question to Joe Biden at the debate: what is your son's middle name? Do you honestly think he could answer that, right? And look, we don't have to go here because I think Biden's policies are horrible. Biden has been wrong on a lot of key issues. He was wrong on the Iraq War, which was a disaster, right? He voted for it. He was wrong on bankruptcy laws and reforms, right? He's probably the worst type of centrist politician. This is why I don't like centrist politicians. They combine the worst aspects of the right and the worst aspects of the left wing into one bipartisan package, which sucks, right? Joe Biden, like what? He's a mediocre politician, and he's just survived because he's the only man left standing. He's never won a competitive race. He was the VP for the far more charismatic and talented Barack Obama. But prior to that, he was a senator from Delaware. Like Delaware, come on. If you and I had $50 and a cheeseburger and we put our minds to it, you and I could get elected, the two senators from Delaware. There's like 12 people there. We could use the cheeseburger to bribe like one voter, the $50 to bribe like the remaining five voters, and then, you know, flip the coin. We would be senators from Delaware. It's not a hard achievement, and Joe Biden is going to be the VP because he's the only man left standing.
And I'm actually actively working right here, and I think I'm going to have it momentarily, the video clip. I'm going to see if I could get this to show up momentarily. Let's see here. All right, I'm going to – all right, let's see if this works. Hopefully we can get this to work here.
Oh, there's like a little video coming up. This is pretty cool.
I guess my only concern is I'm not sure if the audio is going to work. Since we've had a ton of issues tonight.
Yeah.
So, I'm not even sure if that works. So, I apologize. But it was essentially the clip that I was talking about the other day. But, I mean, he has some pretty interesting ones from time to time. But what's working in his favor right now is he could stay in his basement, not do really any sort of interviews, doesn't have to campaign. None of this is really coming to light because, well, they're just not going to cover it because it's going to be COVID-19 and Trump this and some other controversy of some sort. But I think as we open things up, campaigning's inevitably going to happen. It might be different than how it was done in the past. Maybe less rallies, maybe smaller, more intimate environments, restricted number of people coming in. But this will come to light. And this is going to cost them. And I think that the fear for some Democrats has to be the debate. Now, I will say this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's easy for us. I mean, that's a two and a half hour. There's three of them. What? Two and a half hour debate. They could – he could get through that. That's, to me, not my concern. He's actually had a couple pretty good debate performances. But there are times, especially in those ones where there was 10 people on the stage, where he kind of would get lost in the shuffle where he wasn't talking much, and they'd ask him a question and would just say something that made no sense. That's where when he seemed to have his issues. But I'm not so sure. It was sort of like the whole thing with Biden versus Palin. I remember a lot on the right saying, oh, you know, Biden's going to look terrible, you know, look mean to Palin, and really didn't materialize in my eyes. So
Biden versus Paul Ryan, you mean?
Well, I'm talking about in 08 when Sarah Palin.
Oh, earlier. Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
No, sorry. No, that's fine.
You're absolutely right. Yeah.
When that came, there was a hope, I think, on the Republican side that Joe Biden's going to say something that's going to maybe kind of come across demeaning or derogatory in some way, and it's going to look bad. That really never materialized, and I thought he did a pretty good debate there. But the issues that we're seeing now, you know, if there's a pointed question and he stumbles over a name, it's going to look bad, especially with an audience of 70, 80 million people. So take these polls for what they're worth right now. I think a lot of what's those people who are saying they're going to vote for him have in their minds is the vice president of 4 years ago and the vice president of the previous administration. And for us political junkies who love following politics, we know it's not the same guy. So, and I know you asked another question about running mate. I think you got to really watch there. Like somebody like Elizabeth Warren, isn't she over the age of 70? And if you're going to be that transformational campaign that's going to bridge the divide and you know, be an ally of millennials and college age kids, is it really going to be a campaign of what, a 77, 78-year-old and a 70-whatever-year-old in Elizabeth Warren? So I question Elizabeth Warren being a – I don't think Elizabeth Warren's the answer. I don't get this love affair with Whitmer in Michigan that a lot on the left have. Mm-hmm. I don't see it. I think some questions are going to have to be asked of her and how she's handled it up there, especially with like some of the numbers out of Detroit, and then how she's closing the whole state, and yet the Upper Peninsula's had very little, if anything. And it's again one of these one size fits all approaches isn't working. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Who do you think is going to be his VP pick at the end of the day? It has to be a woman.
Yes, yeah.
He said it was a woman.
He said it, but
who do you think it is? Let me ask you. Wait, let me stop. Let me phrase the question. Who do you think is the strongest? Who do you think is the weakest? And who do you think it is?
I would probably say if you want a strong progressive ticket, I would probably say Elizabeth Warren. I think.
Is the what? The strongest, the likeliest, or the worst?
I would say the strongest chance to coalesce the far left, especially those alienated, especially the college students who I think feel alienated, who are going to struggle to support Biden and come to the polls. I think she would probably be a good one there. And I think she's sound on policy. Who I think what are your other two scenarios? Who I think is going to be it?
Who do you think right now? This is a key episode, right? Let's spice it up.
Well, I get
who is going to be his VP pick?
I'm kind of torn between Kamala Harris and maybe Klobuchar. I would say maybe Kamala Harris, but you know, full disclosure, I was very high on Kamala Harris in the first few episodes, and I thought she was going to be
We were aligned.
I think she really had one really, really bad debate that tanked her campaign. But she does – I believe she's a former state attorney general in California. And I think she does have maybe a future in the party. But I would say maybe it's between those two. But I'll be honest. I haven't put a ton of thought into that.
So – okay, you want the answer, right? I'm going to be a jerk. You want the answer. You want the real talk, right?
I want it.
Okay. Here are the three that it comes. Elizabeth Warren's too old, and I don't think Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren like each other. And Elizabeth Warren could potentially be an influential Senate leader. I don't think she does it. She's out of the running. So who's it coming down to? Kamala Harris, clearly, right? She's a African-American. She's a woman. She was previously state attorney general. She's a senator. Her resume looks fantastic, right? Kamala Harris is one candidate. Second candidate, Amy Klobuchar. Again, woman, Midwestern, right? Connects with the suburban soccer moms of the world. Third candidate, Stacey Abrams, the most progressive left of the three. She's got the good left-wing bona fides, but she's never won a big race. If the strongest candidate of those three is Amy Klobuchar, right? Because Amy Klobuchar wins over the suburban vote, which is largely white. She wins them over. She brings them and solidifies the Democratic lead with white women. Joe Biden wins the election. He flips states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. So Amy Klobuchar is the strongest candidate. Kamala Harris is the candidate he actually picks. That's what my brain tells me, because she, as a Black American, the theory goes she drives up Black turnout, which we all know the Democrats need to win, right? The problem is I don't think Blacks really connected with her, as evidenced by the fact that she didn't go anywhere in the primaries and she lost. They all voted for Joe Biden, because I think her father was Jamaican American, which I don't want to go there because it's a tricky subject, right? But like Jamaican Americans are not seen as like fully born and raised African American, right? There's some weird vibes there. And again, far be it from me, a vanilla dude, to go to that area, but there's something there, right? They never really connected with her. She never really sold herself to the Black community. So he's who he thinks he. I think that's who he goes with. That's what my brain says. The argument is it boosts Black turnout. He picks her. She's a mediocre pick. The final candidate is Stacey Abrams, which is really spicy. She's heavily lobbying for the position. She's never won a statewide race. The progressive left loves her, but she's kind of obnoxious. And then she's really going for it hardcore. And she's never won, right? She's never won. That should be an automatic disqualifier. My heart says that Joe Biden picks her because I think she'd be the Sarah Palin of the left. And she would doom his candidacy. I think he picks Kamala Harris. And I think Kamala Harris, at the end of the day, proves to be a big nothing burger, as the millennials like to say, in the sense that she really doesn't boost Black turnout, but she doesn't really hurt Joe Biden with any other demographics. She really has no effects. So that's my take. I don't know. I don't know what people think, but that's the hot take for the moment.
Well, I'll say this. I don't know. I guess it's a very important pick for Biden because I think it's important for him. He needs to reassure his base and independent voters that, let's say, if something were to happen. And, again, we've talked about his mental or memory issues and his cognitive decline. If something were to happen, so who could truly step in? I think Stacey Abrams is a very risky pick because, like you said, she's never won statewide.
Right.
You're going to throw her. She is very much like a Sarah Palin pick. There's a certain you think she's going to help you with certain demographics, maybe in your base, but it ultimately backfires because the key swing independent voters don't buy it. And I think that would be her big issue. I think he really put himself in a tough situation when he said, I am going to select a woman. Not saying there isn't qualified women, but you're limiting yourself And there could have been plenty of qualified, men as well who may have played well in this particular election in certain parts of the country. So I don't know if it's one of those things where maybe his campaign was like, why did you say that? You know, don't limit yourself right away. Let's have a committee. Let's look at all the candidates. Let's interview him, because who knows how well he's going to be with Amy Klobuchar, who you read things that she could be a bit of a pain with some of, like,
she's evil. No, it's not. Michael, you're too nice. You're a nice young man.
I'm just going off of what I hear. So
she's evil. She made her staffers eat salad with a comb. That's fucked up. Pardon my language. That's messed up. Right? She's not a nice person, Amy Klobuchar, right? First of all, anybody that makes it to the U.S. Senate, 9 times out of 10, those aren't nice people. Second of all, Amy Klobuchar, this isn't because she's a woman. So all the feminists listening to this, just shut up, right? It's not because she's a woman. It's because she made her staffers eat salad with a comb. That was a real story. I'm not making this up. I'm not on drugs. I'm not like on LSD and just saying words because I have Tourette syndrome. She made her staffers eat salad with a comb. That's messed. Amy Klobuchar, she clearly gives off like I'm not a nice person vibes, right? Just – you don't have to trust me, okay? Just go on YouTube. Type in Amy Klobuchar, Minnesota, right? And watch one of those videos and ask yourself, would you want her as your substitute teacher, Michael Metzinger?
Well, I got to watch the videos first.
She's a Karen. Yeah. Tommy just said she's a Karen. She's the biggest Karen in the world. She's a huge Karen. Oh, God. Tommy's here. Yeah. He's live. He's alive.
He's been alive this entire time in the podcast recording side. But our technical difficulties on the video streaming side has limited our abilities to actually allow him to broadcast on there. So epic fail on my part. That's one's on me. I'll get these issues addressed in future episodes. Lord knows we need to, because I'll throw a few things out there. So we're hoping to get some guests on. We've thrown a couple.
We need guests.
What's that?
Yeah. We need guests. We need libs. If you're a lib, get on our show.
We welcome liberals on our show. So we've thrown a couple feelers out there. Christina Hagan, the Republican candidate who won in the 13th congressional district. I think she beat, like I said, 7 or 8 other people. She took 62% of the vote. So we threw something out. I threw something out there and said, hey, we'd love to have you on the podcast. Sort of made it sound like there's some interest there. And then the real fascinating one has been, and we'll talk about this in a minute, is David Pepper, the chairman of the Ohio Democrat Party, kind of going back and forth with him on Twitter over an election analysis I did for the state of Ohio. And I'm like, hey, would you be interested in joining the podcast? He said, or coming on a podcast episode. He said, sure. So we're trying to get some not just any old random guests, some pretty good guests. I have somebody else who I know who is working in D.C., who's from Ohio, who's worked on some campaigns, trying to get him on as well. So we're trying to get some others, people who are actually in the political field and seeing things, how they work behind the scenes, and kind of ask, allow you guys in the chat to ask questions. And we got some other things we'd like to ask them. So let me touch upon that election data I did for the state of Ohio. So I'm kind of been fascinated lately with reading different articles and hearing people talk, how they kind of are ignoring Ohio as a swing state in 2020. And I've been trying to figure out why. Now, we've had a discussion on the show why we think Ohio's trending in some ways to the right for some different reasons. And one could argue that Ohio, especially statewide in terms of state races, is a very red state. I mean, probably over the last 20 years, the only year the Democrats have had any success statewide would have been in 08 when – was it 08 or 20 what year would Strickland would have won?
2000.
Okay, was it – I wasn't sure. If it was 08, but that's the last election that I think it was 06. I could be wrong. I didn't think that the governors were the same year as the president. I thought they were on the off year. But regardless, that was the only time, I think, in the last 20 years that the Democrats have won statewide. So I kind of looked at the election data, and I tried to ask myself, I said, DeWine, Trump won the state by 8 percentage points, 447,000 votes. Pretty substantial mark for a swing state. So I said, well, let's give Hillary Clinton all the states that Barack Obama won, and let's give her those states with the margins that Obama won, won by. And let's just see what happens. Because I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, maybe it's an issue with the Democrat parties that Democrat counties that went Republican. Not so much. The margin goes from 8% down to 4%, and the margin's still 222,000 votes. So the point I was trying to make in my thread on Twitter was how far right so many of the counties went in the state of Ohio. Trump won 80 of the 88 counties in the state. And, you know, I thought I was being generous giving Hillary a lot of these other counties back, some of these ones that Obama won that Hillary lost, and give her these decent margins. And it still only trimmed the margin by 4 percentage points. So the point I was trying to make was, in 2020, even if Hillary wins back a lot of these Democrat areas like Trumbull, like Mahoning County,
Joe Biden.
I'm pulling at Joe Biden right now. Can Biden win the state? Oh, and the point was, I was just trying to make is, I think it would be, it's attainable, especially in a good year for the Democrats. But I do think if Trump holds a decent amount of his voters from 2016 to 2020, he's going to be hard to beat. And I think the best illustration of really where Ohio is politically would be the 2018 gubernatorial election between Cordray and DeWine. DeWine won it by, I think, around 4 percentage points. But if you kind of look at it, Mahoning Valley went blue, but not, again, at the margins you would typically expect. I think DeWine lost here by maybe between 10 and 12 percentage points, but you would typically expect it to be closer to 20 to 25 percentage points, when a lot of the other state was red. But a lot of the blue counties remained blue. A lot of the red counties were pretty red. But I kind of see that is where Ohio is politically right now, about maybe a 2 to 4 point Republican edge statewide.
Yeah, I mean, look, Ohio demographically is trending Republican. I would love to have David Tepper on, because I would love – is it Pepper or Pepper? Tepper? It's Pepper, right? I keep – Pepper. Look, the Democratic Party has changed. It's a party of the coasts and the coastal elites. It's a party of the very poor and the very wealthy aligned against the middle. It's a party which is not a party, I think, that it used to be, right? The Democratic Party, in the noblest sense, or in its idolized images of itself, was a party that fought for the working class. I don't think it fights for the working class anymore. I think it fights for the white collar McKinsey consultant in New York that makes $400,000 a year, and the illegal immigrant that, you know, makes $8 an hour under the table. And it's those two groups that the Democratic Party fights for. And that's why it's lost Ohio. I mean, it's the party of, you know, what college educated kids, upper middle class kids in Brooklyn who have trust funds, lecturing people dying of heroin overdoses in Youngstown and in Trumbull County, et cetera, that they have white privilege, and telling them they have white privilege as they, you know, die from heroin overdose and they're trying to find a job. Meanwhile, you know, in Brooklyn, yeah, they're tweeting out how they're fighting for, you know, some cause, right? That's the Democratic Party of the 21st century. It has no organic connection with the working class. And as such, it's lost Ohio. I'd love to talk to David Pepper, and I'd love to ask him, you know, how does having total open borders of legal and illegal immigration, how does that help the working class, right? I'm an investment banker. I'm not competing against illegal immigrants, or legal immigrants for that matter. It doesn't hurt me, but it hurts somebody that makes their wage by selling their labor. How does having total unrestricted trade with the rest of the world? Biden is a free trader, right? Trump is the more protectionist president. How does having open trade with China, how does that help the working class in Ohio? We've had 20 years of data. I used to be a free trader. The data is very clear that it doesn't help them. So that's why Ohio has lost. That's why Ohio has moved to the Republican Party. And I think the Republican Party is transitioning to a more nationalistic, populist movement, which I think is good because it'll win and it'll do better. Like, how do you win Hispanics? Do you win Hispanics and Black Americans by like pandering to them and having like, oh, yo, you know, let me run Republican advertisements in Spanish? That doesn't fucking work. The way you win these groups is by saying, hey, look, you're part of the working class. We're going to fight for working class voters, right? You know, Hispanic Americans are moving increasingly towards Trump, who has some of the strongest rhetoric on the border on that. Why? This is a mystery, right? Well, it's because Hispanic Americans that are legal citizens of the United States, they are some of the worst affected by illegal immigration because those people are competing against them in the job market and pushing down their wages or holding them down, right? Preventing wages from rising. So, look, that's a long spiel. I'm sorry. It's kind of off topic, but that's why Ohio has moved red. And that's why it's no longer a swing state. And that's why Democrats, by the way, being pro open borders and illegal immigration, being pro H-1B visas and all these other legal immigration things, it's not their conservative position. I'm sick of the little meme that's like, oh, I'm against illegal immigration, but I'm for legal immigration, right? We take 1.5 million legal immigrants a year. That's why Georgia, Texas, and these other states are trending blue. That's why California, which used to be one of the most Republican states in the country, has turned blue. Okay, we need to control our borders. It's not a race thing. I don't care what race you are. It's none of that. It's we need to control and protect our own people. We need to protect the wages of the most disadvantaged. And the way to do that, ironically, is through the Republican Party. So there you go. There's my spiel.
What was fascinating, and the more I think of it with David Pepper, I remember this, and I just found an article from the Cleveland Plain Dealer after the 2018 election where – former chairman of the Mahoning County Democrat Party, Dave Beatrice, was not very happy with the state Democrat performance and kind of went after David Pepper in a memo. He just pretty much said it was a flawed strategy where Democrats had some success where I think they're doing fairly well is around Franklin County, Columbus, and maybe some of those more college-educated suburbanites or whatever you want to call them. I think maybe they might be winning some of them over, maybe a little bit around Hamilton County and Cincinnati. But again, you could win them over when you have 86 other counties that are trending the other way. It's going to offset it. So I would love to have David Pepper on, whether we can do it live or whether we just have to record it on our own and then play it for you. We'll see what we could pull off. But I think it would be a great opportunity to have somebody, especially with the knowledge that he has of statewide politics. I believe he also, at one point in time, I think in 06, he won statewide. I'm just not sure of his position that he had. I don't know if it was like I don't think he was attorney general, but maybe like state auditor or something like that. So we'll see what we could pull off there. But I think that would be pretty great to have him on. And, you know, we were talking about the state and kind of where we see it. There was an Emerson poll out this week that had Trump up 46-43 here, which is kind of in line with where I would expect it to be. He won the state, like I said, by 8 points. Just overall, a lot of the polls have trended where in a lot of the different states where he's down probably about 3 to 5 points in a lot of states from where he won them in 2016. But again, I fully expect these states to tighten up in the months ahead.
So really quickly, and I know we're reaching the end of the episode, but I want to say this, okay? I want to drop some truth bombs, as the millennials like to call it. First of all, one, Barack Obama lost to every generic Republican except for when Mitt Romney was on the ballot, and then Barack Obama started winning. I think the inverse is true with Trump. Trump loses to a generic Democrat, and right now Biden is the generic Democrat, right, because he's kind of run a campaign from his basement. I've done more campaigning for president by doing this silly little podcast with you, Michael Metzinger, in Youngstown, Ohio, than Joe Biden has, right? And Joe Biden's running for president. We're more public than Joe Biden is. He's like hiding in his basement and is like calling into Chris Cuomo and then forgetting where he is, okay? So the moment Trump goes up against Biden, Biden becomes far more public, those polls are going to change. I would short – if they were stocks, I would buy Trump and short Biden. Now, I don't know who's going to win the election, okay? But I'm just saying right now, Biden is at a high point. Trump's at a low point. Point number one. Point number two, okay? The – you know, somebody like David Pepper. David Pepper's father was the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, right? The upper middle class votes Democrat because it acts as the great moral – absolution for them, right? It used to be when America was largely a Christian country, people had what was called sin and they felt guilty because they did things wrong and they'd go to a priest and confess. Or if they weren't Catholic, if they were Protestant, they would go and they would do good deeds and they would confess. So they would pray to God and confess. The modern reality is we've lost Christianity by and large for half of this country, if not more. So what do people do when they feel guilty? Because people still feel human guilt. They go and they vote Democrat. Okay, so the Democratic Party function today is acting as the confession booth for the upper middle class. The upper middle class has disproportionate income and control and influence in this country. Okay, and these people feel guilty about it because they're like, you know, I'm smart, but I'm not really that smart. I shouldn't make $250,000 a year. I'm really not that much better than everybody else. I feel guilty about this. So what do? They say, oh, you know, I have white privilege, and they post about it on Facebook. Oh, you know, rest in peace, Trayvon Martin. Post about it on Facebook. Oh, I feel so guilty. Let me vote for Democrat. And the Democratic Party just ratifies the status quo, but it lets them absolve all the guilt that they feel. That's what it does. That's the neoliberal Democratic win. That's Joe Biden. Oh, I feel guilty. You know, there's sexual assault out there and there's racism out there. I feel so bad about these things. And I'm an educated member of society and I read The Economist and I read The Atlantic and I'm really intelligent because I read those magazines and I just feel so much guilt. Oh, let me vote for Joe Biden. You know, I'm so much smarter than everybody else. And let me condemn these protesters. Boom, I vote for him, and oh, I feel so much better. I'm making a difference, right? That's all the Democratic Party does. It doesn't help the poor. It doesn't help the working classes. Just ask yourself a very basic question if you're kind of on the fence. You know, look at California and New York and Illinois. These are some of the states with the worst income inequality in the country. Look at the states in the west of the United States, like Texas. I'd much rather be poor in Texas. I have better school results and I have lower income inequality. I have a much better opportunity to get ahead than I would in California. So sorry, I got too red-pilled. I'm just dropping truth bombs. Pew, 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 dropping the truth bombs.
No, I think one thing that we still have not figured out is the political maneuvering that took place to allow Biden become the nominee. Because remember this. I remember – I think I was on – working in Florida for a week on an audit when this took place. It would have been I think Nevada or the – I'm not sure which. Maybe it was New Hampshire. Biden got beat up pretty bad. And then Nevada came and he got beat up real bad. And his safety net was going to be South Carolina because of the African-American vote. He did really well there. And despite the fact that Mayor Pete and –
Mayor Pete,
Amy Klobuchar, Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that some of them, well, not let's exclude Bloomberg from this. Some of these other ones actually had some fairly decent results in the early states. They all decided to drop out after South Carolina. Something happened in the background. And
yes,
I'd love to know what happened because it just seemed very questionable that you know, you work that hard, you bust your ass, and you're just going to drop out because we're going to – somebody in – I don't know if it was Obama. I don't know who it was, but there was some sort of maneuvering that took place in the background to anoint Biden as the nominee because that's essentially what happened. Because if that thing – if that would have gone on, I think Bloomberg may have had a decent Super Tuesday, and I think he would have – taken quite a few, as well, this was before the whole Bloomberg debate debacle. But I think some of those other candidates would have taken a lot of the Biden vote, and Biden would not have had the great Super Tuesday that he had. But something happened there, and I don't know. I think some are going to be regretting that decision. I'm not saying that Mayor Pete would have been a great candidate, because I don't think that at all. But I'm not saying I thought any of them would have been necessarily great candidates to take on Trump. I think if any of them, the one who's furthest out there is probably I know I argued this in one episode. Bernie Sanders, I thought he would have been a very tough challenger, because he's at least been consistent over the years, unlike a lot of the other ones. So I wish some sort of investigative reporter, somebody out there would shed some light as to what happened there.
Guys, let me just put this. Joe Biden, to your point, Michael, I think that was an excellent analysis. Joe Biden is a puppet. Okay. He's a puppet. He's lost it. Okay. I feel bad for the guy. Say a prayer for the guy, but he's lost it. He's a puppet, and he's going to be controlled by the same interest that control the Democratic Party. Okay, and they believe in total open borders, and that doesn't help you if you're like Joe Schmo, kind of on the fence. Like, Trump is really vulgar and nasty. I don't like him, but I'm not sure about these Democrats. Don't vote for him. Okay, don't vote. They don't care about you. They really don't care about you. They don't care about the working class. They don't care about. They care about power. That's all they want, right? If they really cared about – if the Democratic Party cared about the working class in America, then they should be singing the praises of Trump for putting on tariffs on China, right? Prior to this whole COVID crisis, people without a college degree saw the strongest income gains of the 21st century. Why? Because they were no longer competing against illegal immigrants and Chinese workers because of the modest protection measures that Trump was able to implement, right? The Democrats should have done that. Barack Obama was elected in 2008. He never took us out of NATO. He did nothing on trade. He was weak sauce on trade, okay? The only thing Barack Obama pushed forward was some convoluted healthcare plan called Obamacare, which really at the end of the day was just an expansion of Medicaid. And if you like that, well, then push for an expansion of Medicaid. So here's my point. Here's my big concluding point. Given all this craziness, right, Joe Biden's lost it. He's a puppet of the Democratic establishment. You might not like Trump, but at the end of the day, it's a question of, like, who's really looking out for you? I don't think Trump is looking out for you, but I know that Trump's policies, perhaps maybe indirectly, will help out middle-class people and will help out working-class people. I know for a fact that Democratic policies won't help out these people at all. So vote Trump. There you go.
Vote Trump. I guess my concluding point would be, I think it says a lot right now. You know, the economy, let's exclude the stock market here. The economy's in the tank because of the shutdowns. We'll see what kind of response we get. One could argue that Trump's overall response hasn't been great. Maybe, you know, maybe give him a C+ type of thing. There, you know, he did institute the China ban, which definitely saved lives. And surprisingly, I would say, with his personality, he has allowed, to an extent, Fauci and Burks and listened to their guidance and kind of pushed forward and adhered to it. But the economy's in the tank. He's done a questionable job on this. If the Democrats had a great candidate, that 5 or 6 point edge that Biden has right now, I think would be double, if not a lot. Not more. I know there's something that can be said about, like, in a time of crisis, you know, voters maybe will kind of go with the current leader. And there's been some different scenarios like that. But I do think it does say a lot right now. And there's got to be someone on the left got to be wondering and be like, the economy's in the tank. This guy's doing a sketchy job as president. He's got they like to say he's got a corrupt administration, and we're still only up 5 points in the polls. I think it does say a lot about the Democrat side as well. And I think they have lost touch with the key swing voters who I think they thought they automatically had, but there are some swing voters who are just I don't think buying into Biden and are willing to give Trump another 4 years, which I think ultimately will help Trump get reelected when it's all said and done.
Yeah, I think Biden's 5-point lead, and let's call it 5 points, right? I think that's where the polls are clustering. I think it's an illusion. I think people are imagining the Biden from 08 and 12. They're not imagining the Biden of today that's lost half of his brain. And I'm not saying that to gloat. It's just reality. And, you know, a lot of people don't like Trump. But let me ask you, you know, very real question. If somebody like Biden were to take power, what do you think is going to happen to fracking? What do you think is going to happen to domestic U.S. energy production? What do you think is going to happen to the tariffs on China? Those have been really helpful. They're going to go away. What do you think is going to happen to the wall and illegal immigration and legal immigration? Those are going to get expanded, right? How do you think that's going to help you? Like, why is the United States importing H-1B visas when we have 30 million people unemployed? Can anybody answer me that? Trump's the only one that said, like, hey, we're going to freeze immigration. The Democrats are like, oh, my God, that's racist. That's like their argument for everything, right? It's like, hey, you know, it's a little too cold in this room. Let me turn up the thermometer to 72 degrees. Oh, my God, that's racist. Hey, do you want to go to Chick-fil-A or do you want to go to Arby's? Oh, my God, that's racist, right? That's their argument for everything. They don't have policy arguments anymore. I remember, like, growing up, the Democrats had real policy arguments. Now it's just, hey, that's racist. That's racist. Hey, that's racist. As if, like, that's the end-all, be-all, right? So I don't know. I would short Biden. I would long Trump. I'm not trying to be a Trump booster. I have a lot of problems with Trump. I think he's run a horrible campaign so far. But I'm telling you right now, where Trump, Biden is, it's overbought.
And it is worth mentioning the last time. I think I mentioned this on the last episode. The betting markets do have Trump as a slight favorite right now. So take that for what it's worth. But I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I certainly want to apologize for the many technical issues throughout the hour. We'll have to figure those out. But I know the audio side is going to be fine. So certainly please download, subscribe to the podcast, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, all those spots. If there are any liberals listening, by all means, if you like politics and would love to come on, let us know. Message us on Facebook or tweet at us or anything like that. We're open to having people on. And hopefully when we do have them on, the technology will work in our favor.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Michael, it was a pleasure as always. And listen, the technical difficulties are obviously because they don't want us to drop the truth bombs on the American people. So you should take that as actually a compliment that, you know, we're dropping the truth on the American people, and that's why they're trying to shut us down. That's, you know, it's not because of technical difficulties. That's a bogus answer. It's because they're trying to shut us down. Now, I'll let the listener define who they is, right? I'm not going to go there. But
they might just have to do some Google searching into whoever this BeLive.tv is, where they're headquartered.
Yeah.
Maybe that would give people the answer. But again, thank you everybody for tuning in. Share this episode, preferably the audio side rather than the video side, since we had these issues, with your fellow political friends and family. And we'll talk to you here in a couple weeks. Take care, everybody.